Be trouble. Will emigrate. Wednesday. I have had a variegated time. I escaped that night and rode a horse all night as fast as he could go, hoping to get clear out of the garden and hide in some other country before the trouble should begin. But it was not to be. About an hour after sunup, as I was riding through a flowery plain, where thousands of animals were grazing, slumbering, or playing with each other, according to their common wont, all of a sudden they broke into a tempest of frightful noises, and in one moment the plain was a frantic commotion, and every beast was destroying its neighbor. I knew what it meant. Eve had eaten that fruit, and death was come into the world. The tigers ate my horse, paying no attention when I ordered them to desist, and they would even have eaten me if I had stayed, which I didn't, but went away, in much haste. I found this place outside the garden and was fairly comfortable for a few days, but she has found me out and has named the place Tonawanda. Says it looks like that. In fact, I was not sorry she came, for there are but meager pickings here, and she brought some of those apples. I was obliged to eat them, I was so hungry. It was against my principles, but I find that principles have no real force except when one is well fed. She came curtained in boughs and bunches of leaves, and when I asked her what she meant by such nonsense, and snatched them away and threw them down, she tittered and blushed. I had never seen a person titter and blush before, and to me it seemed unbecoming and idiotic. She said I would soon know how it was myself. This was correct. Hungry as I was, I laid down the apple, half-eaten, certainly the best one I ever saw, considering the lateness of the season, and arrayed myself in the discarded boughs and branches, and then spoke to her with some severity, and ordered her to go and get some more, and not make such a spectacle of herself. She did it, and after this we crept down to where the wild beast battle had been, and collected some skins, and I made her patch together a couple of suits, proper for public occasions. They are uncomfortable, it is true, but stylish, and that is the main point about clothes. I find she is a good deal of a companion. I see I should be lonesome and depressed without her, now that I have lost my property. Another thing, she says it is ordered that we work for our living hereafter. She will be useful. I will superintend. 10 days later, she accuses me of being the cause of our disaster. She says, with apparent sincerity and truth, that the serpent assured her that the forbidden fruit was not apples, it was chestnuts. I said I was innocent then, for I had not eaten any chestnuts. She said the serpent informed her that chestnut was a figurative term, meaning an aged and moldy joke. I turned pale at that, for I have made many jokes to pass the weary time, and some of them could have been of that sort, though I had honestly supposed they were new when I made them. She asked me if I had made one just at the time of the catastrophe. I was obliged to admit that I had made one, to myself, though not aloud. It was this. I was thinking about the falls, and I said to myself how wonderful it is to see that vast body of water tumble down there. And then, in an instant, a bright thought flashed into my head, and I let it fly, saying, it would be a deal more wonderful to see it tumble up there. And I was just about to kill myself with laughing at it, when all nature broke loose in war and death, and I had to flee for my life. There, she said with triumph, that is just it. The serpent mentioned that very jest, and called it the first chestnut, and said it was coeval with the creation. Alas, I am indeed to blame. Would that I were not witty. Oh, would that I had never had that radiant thought! next year. We have named it Cain. She caught it while I was up country trapping on the north shore of the Erie, caught it in the timber a couple of miles from our dugout, or it might have been four, she isn't certain which. It resembles us in some ways, and may be a relation. That is what she thinks, but this is an error in my judgment. The difference in size warrants the conclusion that it is a different and new kind of animal. A fish, perhaps, though when I put it in the water to see, it sank, and she plunged in and snatched it out before there was opportunity for the experiment to determine the matter. I still think it is a fish, but she is indifferent about what it is, and will not let me have it to try. I do not understand this. The coming of the creature seems to have changed her whole nature, and made her unreasonable about experiments. She thinks more of it than she does of any of the other animals, but is not able to explain why. Her mind is disordered. Everything shows it. Sometimes she carries the fish in her arms half the night, when it complains and wants to get to the water. At such times the water comes out of the places in her face that she looks out of, and she pats the fish on the back and makes soft sounds with her mouth to soothe it, and betrays sorrow and solicitude in a hundred ways. I've never seen her do like this with any other fish, and it troubles me greatly. She used to carry the young tigers around so and play with them before we lost our property, but it was only play. She never took on about them like this when their dinner disagreed with them. Sunday. She don't work Sundays, but lies around all tired out, and likes to have the fish wallow over her, and she makes fool noises to amuse it, and pretends to chew its paws, and that makes it laugh. I have not seen a fish before that could laugh. This makes me doubt. I've come to like Sunday myself. Superintending all the week tires a body so. There ought to be more Sundays. In the old days they were tough, but now they come handy. Wednesday. It isn't a fish. I cannot quite make out what it is. It makes curious, devilish noises when not satisfied, and says goo-goo when it is. It is not one of us, for it doesn't walk. It is not a bird, for it doesn't fly. It is not a frog, for it doesn't hop. It is not a snake, for it doesn't crawl. I feel sure it is not a fish, though I cannot get a chance to find out whether it can swim or not. It merely lies around, and mostly on its back, with its feet up. I have not seen any other animal do that before. I said I believed it was an enigma, but she only admired the word without understanding it. In my judgment, it is either an enigma or some kind of a bug. If it dies, I will take it apart and see what its arrangements are. I never had a thing perplex me so. 3 months later, the perplexity merely augments instead of diminishing. I sleep but little. It has ceased from lying around and goes about on its four legs now. Yet it differs from the other four-legged animals in that its front legs are unusually short. Consequently, this causes the main part of its person to stick up uncomfortably high in the air, and this is not attractive. It is built much as we are, but its method of traveling shows that it is not of our breed. The short front legs and long hind ones indicate that it is of the kangaroo family, but it is a marked variation of the species, since the true kangaroo hops, whereas this one never does. Still, it is a curious and interesting variety, and has not been catalogued before. As I discovered it, I have felt justified in securing the credit of the discovery by attaching my name to it, and hence have called it Kangaroorum adamiensis. It must have been a young one when it came, for it has grown exceedingly since. It must be 5 times as big now as it was then, and when discontented, is able to make from 22 to 38 times the noise it made at first. Coercion does not modify this, but has the contrary effect. For this reason I discontinued the system. She reconciles it by persuasion, and by giving it things which she had told it she wouldn't give it before. As observed previously, I was not at home when it first came, and she told me she found it in the woods. It seems odd that it should be the only one, yet it must be so, for I have worn myself out these many weeks trying to find another one to add to my collection, and for this one to play with. For surely then it would be quieter, and we could tame it more easily. But I find none, nor any vestige of any, and, strangest of all, no tracks. It has to live on the ground, it cannot help itself. Therefore, how does it get about without leaving a track? I've set 12 traps, but they do no good. I catch all small animals except that one. Animals that merely go into the trap out of curiosity, I think, to see what the milk is there for. They never drink it. 3 months later, the kangaroo still continues to grow, which is very strange and perplexing. I never knew one to be so long getting its growth. It has fur on its head now, not like kangaroo fur, but exactly like our hair, except that it is much finer and softer, and instead of being black is red. I am like to lose my mind over the capricious and harassing developments of this unclassifiable zoological freak. If I could catch another one, but that is hopeless. It is a new variety, and the only sample. This is plain. But I caught a true kangaroo and brought it in, thinking that this one, being lonesome, would rather have that for company than have no kin at all, or any animal it could feel a nearness to, or get sympathy from, in its forlorn condition here among strangers, who do not know its ways or habits, or what to do to make it feel that it is among friends. But it was a mistake. It went into such fits at the sight of the kangaroo that I was convinced it had never seen one before. I pity the poor noisy little animal, but there is nothing I can do to make it happy. If I could tame it, but that is out of the question. The more I try, the worse I seem to make it. It grieves me to the heart to see it in its little storms of sorrow and passion. I wanted to let it go, but she wouldn't hear of it. That seemed cruel and not like her. And yet she may be right. It might be lonelier than ever, for since I cannot find another one, how could it? 5 months later. It is not a kangaroo. No, for it supports itself by holding to her finger, and thus goes a few steps on its hind legs, and then falls down. It is probably some kind of a bear, and yet it has no tail, as yet, and no fur, except on its head. It still keeps on growing. That is a curious circumstance, for bears get their growth earlier than this. Bears are dangerous, since our catastrophe, and I shall not be satisfied to have this one prowling about the place much longer without a muzzle on. I've offered to get her a kangaroo if she would let this one go, but it did no good. She is determined to run us into all sorts of foolish risks, I think. She was not like this before she lost her mind. A fortnight later, I examined its mouth. There is no danger yet. It has only 1 tooth. It has no tail yet. It makes more noise now than it ever did before, and mainly at night. I have moved out, but I shall go over mornings to breakfast, and to see if it has more teeth. If it gets a mouthful of teeth, it will be time for it to go, tail or no tail. for a bear does not need a tail in order to be dangerous. 4 months later, I have been off hunting and fishing a month, up in the region that she calls Buffalo. I don't know why, unless it is because there are not any buffaloes there. Meantime, the bear has learned to paddle around all by itself on its hind legs, and says Papa and Mama. It is certainly a new species. This resemblance to words may be purely accidental, of course, and may have no purpose or meaning, but even in that case it is still extraordinary, and is a thing which no other bear can do. This imitation of speech, taken together with general absence of fur and entire absence of tail, sufficiently indicates that this is a new kind of bear. The further study of it will be exceedingly interesting. Meantime, I will go off on a far expedition among the forests of the north and make an exhaustive search. There must certainly be another one somewhere, and this one will be less dangerous when it has company of its own species. I will go straightway, but I will muzzle this one first. 3 months later. It has been a weary, weary hunt, yet I have had no success. In the meantime, without stirring from the home estate, she has caught another one. I never saw such luck. I might have hunted these woods 100 years. I never would have run across that thing. Next day, I have been comparing the new one with the old one, and it is perfectly plain that they are the same breed. I was going to stuff one of them for my collection, but she is prejudiced against it for some reason or other, so I have relinquished the idea, though I think it is a mistake. It would be an irreparable loss to science if they should get away. The old one is tamer than it was, and can laugh, and talk like the parrot, having learned this, no doubt, from being with the parrot so much, and having the imitative faculty in a highly developed degree. I shall be astonished if it turns out to be a new kind of parrot, and yet I ought not to be astonished, for it has already been everything else it could think of, since those first days when it was a fish. The new one is as ugly now as the old one was at first, has the same sulphur and raw meat complexion, and the same singular head, without any fur on it. She calls it Abel. 10 years later. They are boys. We found it out long ago. It was their coming in that small, immature shape that fooled us. We were not used to it. There are some girls now. Abel is a good boy, but if Cain had stayed a bear, it would have improved him. After all these years, I see that I was mistaken about Eve in the beginning. It is better to live outside the garden with her than inside it without her. At first I thought she talked too much, but now I should be sorry to have that voice fall silent and pass out of my life. Blessed be the chestnut that brought us near together, and taught me to know the goodness of her heart and the sweetness of her spirit. 1893. The Man That Corrupted Hadleyburg. Chapter 1. It was many years ago. Hadleyburg was the most honest and upright town in all the region round about. It had kept that reputation unsmirched during 3 generations, and was prouder of it than of any other of its possessions. It was so proud of it and so anxious to ensure its perpetuation that it began to teach the principles of honest dealing to its babies in the cradle, and made the like teachings the staple of their culture thenceforward, through all the years devoted to their education. Also, throughout the formative years, temptations were kept out of the way of the young people, so that their honesty could have every chance to harden and solidify and become a part of their very bone. The neighboring towns were jealous of this honorable supremacy, and affected to sneer at Hadleyburg's pride in it, and call it vanity. But all the same they were obliged to acknowledge that Hadleyburg was in reality an incorruptible town. And, if pressed, they would also acknowledge that the mere fact that a young man hailed from Hadleyburg was all the recommendation he needed when he went forth from his natal town to seek for responsible employment. But, at last, in the drift of time, Hadleyburg had the ill luck to offend a passing stranger, possibly without knowing it, certainly without caring, for Hadleyburg was sufficient unto itself, and cared not a rap for strangers or their opinions. Still, it would have been well to make an exception in this one's case, for he was a bitter man and revengeful. All through his wanderings during a whole year he kept his injury in mind, and gave all his leisure moments to trying to invent a compensating satisfaction for it. He contrived many plans, and all of them were good, but none of them was quite sweeping enough. The poorest of them would hurt a great many individuals, but what he wanted was a plan which would comprehend the entire town, and not let so much as one person escape unhurt. At last he had a fortunate idea, and when it fell into his brain, it lit up his whole head with an evil joy. He began to form a plan at once, saying to himself, "That is the thing to do. I will corrupt the town." 6 months later he went to Hadleyburg, and arrived in a buggy at the house of the old cashier of the bank about 10 at night. He got a sack out of the buggy, shouldered it, and staggered with it through the cottage yard, and knocked at the door. A woman's voice said,
"Come in,"
and he entered, and set his sack behind the stove in the parlor, saying politely to the old lady, who sat reading the Missionary Herald by the lamp,
"Pray keep your seat, madam. I will not disturb you. There. Now it is pretty well concealed. One would hardly know it was there. Can I see your husband a moment, madam?"
No, he was gone to Brixton, and might not return before morning.
"Very well, madam, it is no matter. I merely wanted to leave that sack in his care, to be delivered to the rightful owner when he shall be found. I am a stranger. He does not know me. I am merely passing through the town tonight to discharge a matter which has been long in my mind. My errand is now completed, and I go, pleased and a little proud, and you will never see me again. There is a paper attached to the sack which will explain everything. Good night, madam."
The old lady was afraid of the mysterious big stranger, and was glad to see him go. But her curiosity was roused, and she went straight to the sack and brought away the paper. It began as follows:
"To be published, or the right man sought out by private inquiry, either will answer. This sack contains gold coin, weighing 164 ounces.
"Mercy on us, and the door not locked!"
Mrs. Richards flew to it all in a tremble, and locked it, then pulled down the window shades, and stood frightened, worried, and wondering if there was anything else she could do toward making herself and the money more safe. She listened a while for burglars, then surrendered to curiosity and went back to the lamp and finished reading the paper.
"I am a foreigner, and am presently going back to my own country to remain there permanently. I am grateful to America for what I have received at her hands during my long stay under her flag, and to one of her citizens, a citizen of Hadleyburg, I am especially grateful for a great kindness done me a year or two ago. Two great kindnesses, in fact. I will explain. I was a gambler. I say I was. I was a ruined gambler. I arrived in this village at night, hungry and without a penny. I asked for help in the dark. I was ashamed to beg in the light. I begged of the right man. He gave me $20, that is to say, he gave me life, as I considered it. He also gave me fortune, for out of that money I have made myself rich at the gaming table. And finally, a remark which he made to me has remained with me to this day, and has at last conquered me, and in conquering has saved the remnant of my morals. I shall gamble no more. Now I have no idea who that man was, but I want him found, and I want him to have this money to give away, throw away, or keep, as he pleases. It is merely my way of testifying my gratitude to him. If I could stay, I would find him myself. But no matter, he will be found. This is an honest town, an incorruptible town, and I know I can trust it without fear. This man can be identified by the remark which he made to me. I feel persuaded that he will remember it. And now my plan is this. If you prefer to conduct the inquiry privately, do so. Tell the contents of this present writing to anyone who is likely to be the right man. If he shall answer, I am the man, the remark I made was so-and-so, apply the test. To wit, open the sack, and in it you will find a sealed envelope containing that remark. If the remark mentioned by the candidate tallies with it, give him the money, and ask no further questions, for he is certainly the right man. But if you shall prefer a public inquiry, then publish this present writing in the local paper, with these instructions added. To wit, 30 days from now let the candidate appear at the town hall at 8 in the evening, Friday, and hand his remark in a sealed envelope to the Reverend Mr. Burgess, if he will be kind enough to act, and let Mr. Burgess there and then destroy the seals of the sack, open it, and see if the remark is correct. If correct, let the money be delivered with my sincere gratitude to my benefactor, thus identified.
Mrs. Richards sat down, gently quivering with excitement, and was soon lost in thinkings, after this pattern.
What a strange thing it is! And what a fortune for that kind man who set his bread afloat upon the waters! If it had only been my husband that did it, for we are so poor, so old and poor!
Then, with a sigh,
But it was not my Edward. No, it was not he that gave a stranger $20. It is a pity, too. I see it now.
Then, with a shudder,
But it is gambler's money, the wages of sin. We couldn't take it. We couldn't touch it. I don't like to be near it. It seems a defilement.
She moved to a farther chair.
I wish Edward would come and take it to the bank. A burglar might come at any moment. It is dreadful to be here all alone with it.
At 11, Mr. Richards arrived, and while his wife was saying,
I am so glad you've come,
he was saying,
I'm so tired. Tired clear out. It is dreadful to be poor and have to make these dismal journeys at my time of life. Always at the grind, grind, grind on a salary. Another man's slave, and he sitting at home in his slippers, rich and comfortable.
I'm so sorry for you, Edward, you know that. But be comforted. We have our livelihood. We have our good name.
Yes, Mary, and that is everything. Don't mind my talk. It's just a moment's irritation and doesn't mean anything. Kiss me. There, it's all gone now, and I am not complaining any more. What have you been getting? What's in the sack?
Then his wife told him the great secret. It dazed him for a moment. Then he said,
It weighs 160 pounds? Why, Mary, it's $40,000. Think of it, a whole fortune. Not 10 men in this village are worth that much. Give me the paper.
He skimmed through it and said,
Isn't it an adventure? Why, it's a romance. It's like the impossible things one reads about in books and never sees in life.
He was well stirred up now, cheerful, even gleeful. He tapped his old wife on the cheek and said humorously,
Why, we're rich, Mary, rich. All we've got to do is to bury the money and burn the papers. If the gambler ever comes to inquire, we'll merely look coldly upon him and say, What is this nonsense you are talking? "'We have never heard of you and your sack of gold before.' "'And then he would look foolish and—'
"'And in the meantime, while you are running on with your jokes, "'the money is still here, and it is fast getting along toward burglar time.'
"'True. "'Very well. What shall we do? "'Make the inquiry private? "'No, not that. It would spoil the romance. "'The public method is better. "'Think what a noise it will make. "'And it will make all the other towns jealous. "'For no stranger would trust such a thing to any town but Hadleyburg, "'and they know it. "'It's a great card for us. "'I must get to the printing office now, or I shall be too late.'
"'But stop! Stop! Don't leave me here alone with it, Edward!'
But he was gone. For only a little while, however. Not far from his own house he met the editor-proprietor of the paper, and gave him the document, and said,
"'Here's a good thing for you, Cox. Put it in.'
"'It may be too late, Mr. Richards, but I'll see.'
At home again, he and his wife sat down to talk the charming mystery over. They were in no condition for sleep. The first question was, who could the citizen have been who gave the stranger the $20? It seemed a simple one. Both answered it in the same breath.
Barclay Goodson!
Yes, said Richards. He could have done it, and it would have been like him, but there's not another in the town.
Everybody will grant that, Edward. Grant it privately, anyway. For 6 months now the village has been its own proper self once more, honest, narrow, self-righteous, and stingy.
It is what he always called it, to the day of his death. Said it right out publicly, too.
Yes, and he was hated for it.
Oh, of course. But he didn't care. I reckon he was the best hated man among us, except the Reverend Burgess.
Well, Burgess deserves it. He will never get another congregation here. Mean as the town is, it knows how to estimate him. Edward, doesn't it seem odd that the stranger should appoint Burgess to deliver the money?
Well, yes, it does. That is...
Why so much that ising? Would you select him?
Well, Mary, maybe the stranger knows him better than this village does.
Much that would help Burgess.
The husband seemed perplexed for an answer. The wife kept a steady eye upon him and waited. Finally, Richard said, with the hesitancy of one who is making a statement which is likely to encounter doubt,
"'Mary, Burgess is not a bad man.'
His wife was certainly surprised.
"'Nonsense!'
she exclaimed.
"'He is not a bad man. I know.' The whole of his unpopularity had its foundation in that one thing, the thing that made so much noise.
That one thing, indeed! As if that one thing wasn't enough all by itself!
Plenty, plenty. Only he wasn't guilty of it.
How you talk! Not guilty of it! Everybody knows he was guilty!
Mary, I give you my word. He was innocent.
I can't believe it, and I don't. How do you know?
It is a confession. I am ashamed, but I will make it. I was the only man who knew he was innocent. I could have saved him, and—well, you know how the town was wrought up. I hadn't the pluck to do it. It would have turned everybody against me. I felt mean, ever so mean, but I didn't dare— I hadn't the manliness to face that.
Mary looked troubled, and for a while was silent. Then she said, stammeringly,
I don't think it would have done for you to—one mustn't. Public opinion. One has to be so careful. So—
It was a difficult road, and she got mired. But after a little she got started again.
It was a great pity, but, why, we couldn't afford it, Edward. We couldn't indeed. Oh, I wouldn't have had you do it for anything.
It would have lost us the goodwill of so many people, Mary. And then,
"'What troubles me now is what he thinks of us, Edward.'
"'He doesn't suspect that I could have saved him.'
"'Oh!' exclaimed the wife, in a tone of relief. "'Well, I am glad of that. "'Well, as long as he doesn't know that you could have saved him, "'Well, that makes it a great deal better. "'Why, I might have known he didn't know, "'because he is always trying to be friendly with us, "'as little encouragement as we give him. "'More than once people have twitted me with it. "'There's the Wilsons and the Wilcoxes and the Harknesses. "'They take a mean pleasure in saying, "'Your friend Burgess, because they know it pesters me. "'I wish he wouldn't persist in liking us so.' I can't think why he keeps it up.
I can explain it. It's another confession. When the thing was new and hot and the town made a plan to ride him on a rail, my conscience hurt me so that I couldn't stand it, and I went privately and gave him notice, and he got out of the town and stayed out till it was safe to come back.
Edward, if the town had found it out...
Don't! It scares me yet to think of it. I repented of it the minute it was done, and I was even afraid to tell you, lest your face might betray it to somebody. I didn't sleep any that night for worrying. But after a few days I saw that no one was going to suspect me, and after that I got to feeling glad I did it. And I feel glad yet, Mary, glad through and through.
Well, so do I now, for it would have been a dreadful way to treat him. "'Yes, I'm glad. "'For really you did owe him that, you know. "'But, Edward, suppose it should come out yet some day?'
"'It won't.
"'Why?'
"'Because everybody thinks it was Goodson.'
"'Of course they would.'
"'Certainly. "'And of course he didn't care. "'They persuaded poor old Salisbury to go and charge it on him, "'and he went blustering over there and did it.' Goodson looked him over, like as if he was hunting for a place on him that he could despise the most. Then he says, "'So you are the committee of inquiry, are you?' Salisbury said that was about what he was. "'Hm! Do they require particulars, or do you reckon a kind of a general answer will do?'
"'If they require particulars, I will come back, Mr. Goodson. I will take the general answer first.
"'Very well, then, tell them to go to hell.' I reckon that's general enough. And I'll give you some advice, Salisbury. When you come back for the particulars, fetch a basket to carry the relics of yourself home in.
Just like Goodson. It's got all the marks. He had only one vanity. He thought he could give advice better than any other person.
It settled the business and saved us, Mary. The subject was dropped.
"'Bless you, I'm not doubting that.'
"'Then they took up the gold sack mystery again, with strong interest. "'Soon the conversation began to suffer breaks, "'interruptions caused by absorbed thinkings. "'The breaks grew more and more frequent. "'At last Richards lost himself wholly in thought. "'He sat long, gazing vacantly at the floor.' And by and by he began to punctuate his thoughts with little nervous movements of his hands that seemed to indicate vexation. Meantime his wife, too, had relapsed into a thoughtful silence, and her movements were beginning to show a troubled discomfort. Finally Richards got up and strode aimlessly about the room, ploughing his hands through his hair, much as a somnambulist might do who was having a bad dream. Then he seemed to arrive at a definite purpose, and without a word he put on his hat and passed quickly out of the house. His wife sat brooding with a drawn face, and did not seem to be aware that she was alone. Now and then she murmured,
"'Lead us not into but we are so poor, so poor. Lead us not into—' Ah, who would be hurt by it? And no one would ever know. Lead us.
The voice died out in mumblings. After a little she glanced up and muttered in a half-frightened, half-glad way,
He is gone. But, oh dear, he may be too late. Too late. Maybe not. Maybe there is still time.
She rose and stood thinking, nervously clasping and unclasping her hands. A slight shudder shook her frame, and she said, out of a dry throat,
God forgive me! It's awful to think such things! But, Lord, how we are made! How strangely we are made!
She turned the light low, and slipped stealthily over and kneeled down by the sack, and felt of its ridgy sides with her hands, and fondled them lovingly, and there was a gloating light in her poor old eyes. She fell into fits of absence, and came half out of them at times to mutter,
If we had only waited! Oh, if we had only waited a little, and not been in such a hurry!
Meantime Cox had gone home from his office and told his wife all about the strange thing that had happened, and they had talked it over eagerly, and guessed that the late Goodson was the only man in the town who could have helped a suffering stranger with so noble a sum as $20. Then there was a pause, and the two became thoughtful and silent, and by nervous and fidgety. At last the wife said, as if to herself,
Nobody knows this secret but the Richardses, and us. Nobody.
The husband came out of his thinkings with a slight start, and gazed wistfully at his wife, whose face was become very pale. Then he hesitatingly rose and glanced furtively at his hat, then at his wife, a sort of mute inquiry. Mrs. Cox swallowed once or twice, with her hand at her throat. Then, in place of speech, she nodded her head. In a moment she was alone, and mumbling to herself. And now Richards and Cox were hurrying through the deserted streets from opposite directions. They met, panting, at the foot of the printing office stairs. By the nightlight there they read each other's face. Cox whispered,
Nobody knows about this but us?
The whispered answer was,
Not a soul. On honor, not a soul.
If it isn't too late to...
The men were starting upstairs. At this moment they were overtaken by a boy, and Cox asked,
Is that you, Johnny?
Yes, sir.
You needn't chip the early mail, nor any mail. Wait till I tell you.
It's already gone, sir.
Gone?
It had the sound of an unspeakable disappointment in it.
Yes, sir. Timetable for Brixton and all the towns beyond changed today, sir. Had to get the papers in 20 minutes earlier than common. I had to rush. If I had been 2 minutes later...
The men turned and walked slowly away, not waiting to hear the rest. Neither of them spoke during 10 minutes. Then Cox said, in a vexed tone,
What possessed you to be in such a hurry, I can't make out?
The answer was humble enough.
I see it now, but somehow I never thought, you know, until it was too late. But the next time...
Next time be hanged! It won't come in 1,000 years!
Then the friends separated without a good night, and dragged themselves home with the gait of mortally stricken men. At their homes their wives sprang up with an eager,
Well?
Then saw the answer with their eyes, and sank down sorrowing, without waiting for it to come in words. In both houses a discussion followed, of a heated sort. A new thing. There had been discussions before, but not heated ones, not ungentle ones. The discussions tonight were a sort of seeming plagiarisms of each other. Mrs. Richards said,
If you had only waited, Edward, if you had only stopped to think. But no, you must run straight to the printing office and spread it all over the world.
It said publish it.
That is nothing. It also said do it privately if you liked. There now, is that true or not?
Why, yes. Yes, it is true. But when I thought what a stir it would make, and
What a compliment it was to Hadleyburg that a stranger should trust it so.
Oh, certainly, I know all that. But if you had only stopped to think, you would have seen that you couldn't find the right man, because he is in his grave, and hasn't left chick nor child nor relation behind him. And as long as the money went to somebody that awfully needed it, and nobody would be hurt by it, and...
She broke down, crying. Her husband tried to think of some comforting thing to say, and presently came out with this.
"But after all, Mary, it must be for the best. It must be. We know that. And we must remember that it was so ordered."
"Ordered? Oh, everything's ordered when a person has to find some way out when he has been stupid. Just the same, it was ordered that the money should come to us in this special way. And it was you that must take it on yourself to go meddling with the designs of Providence. And who gave you the right? It was wicked, that is what it was. Just blasphemous presumption. And no more becoming to a meek and humble professor of—"
"But, Mary, you know how we have been trained all our lives long, like the whole village, till it is absolutely second nature to us to stop not a single moment to think when there's an honest thing to be done."
"Oh, I know it, I know it. It's been one everlasting training and training and training in honesty. Honesty shielded from the very cradle against every possible temptation. And so it's artificial honesty, and weak as water when temptation comes, as we've seen this night. God knows I never had shade nor shadow of a doubt of my petrified and indestructible honesty, until now. And now, under the very first big and real temptation, Edward, it is my belief that this town's honesty is as rotten as mine is. As rotten as yours is. It is a mean town, a hard, stingy town, and hasn't a virtue in the world but this honesty it is so celebrated for and so conceited about. And so help me, I do believe that if ever the day comes that its honesty falls under great temptation, its grand reputation will go to ruin like a house of cards. There now, I've made confession, and I feel better. I am a humbug, and I've been one all my life, without knowing it. Let no man call me honest again. I will not have it."
"Well, Mary, I feel a good deal as you do. I certainly do. It seems strange, too. So strange. I never could have believed it. Never."
A long silence followed. Both were sunk in thought. At last the wife looked up and said,
"I know what you're thinking, Edward."
Richards had the embarrassed look of a person who is caught.
"I am ashamed to confess it, Mary, but—"
"It's no matter, Edward. I was thinking the same question myself."
"I hope so. State it."
"You were thinking, if a body could only guess out what the remark was that Goodson made to the stranger."
"It's perfectly true. I feel guilty and ashamed. And you?"
"I'm past it. Let us make a pallet here. We've got to stand watch till the bank vault opens in the morning and admits the sack. Oh, dear, if we hadn't made the mistake."
The pallet was made. And Mary said,
"The open sesame! What could it have been? I do wonder what that remark could have been. But come, we will get to bed now."
"And sleep?"
"No, think."
"Yes, think."
By this time the Coxes, too, had completed their spat and their reconciliation and were turning in. To think. To think and toss and fret, and worry over what the remark could possibly have been which Goodson made to the stranded derelict. That golden remark, that remark worth $40,000 cash. The reason that the village telegraph office was open later than usual that night was this. The foreman of Cox's paper was the local representative of the Associated Press. One might say its honorary representative, for it wasn't four times a year that he could furnish 30 words that would be accepted. But this time it was different. His dispatch, stating what he had caught, got an instant answer.
"Send the whole thing, all the details, 1,200 words.
A colossal order. The foreman filled the bill, and he was the proudest man in the state. By breakfast time the next morning, the name of Hadleyburg the Incorruptible was on every lip in America, from Montreal to the Gulf, from the glaciers of Alaska to the orange groves of Florida, and millions of people were discussing the stranger and his money sack, and wondering if the right man would be found, and hoping some more news about the matter would come soon, right away. The Man That Corrupted Hadleyburg, Chapter 2. Hadleyburg Village woke up world-celebrated, astonished, happy, vain beyond imagination. Its 19 principal citizens and their wives went about shaking hands with each other, and beaming and smiling and congratulating, and saying this thing adds a new word to the dictionary, Hadleyburg, synonym for incorruptible, destined to live in dictionaries forever. And the minor and unimportant citizens and their wives went around acting in much the same way. Everybody ran to the bank to see the gold sack, and before noon, grieved and envious crowds began to flock in from Brixton and all neighboring towns. And that afternoon and next day, reporters began to arrive from everywhere to verify the sack and its history, and write the whole thing up anew, and make dashing freehand pictures of the sack, and of Richards's house, and the bank, and the Presbyterian Church, and the Baptist Church, and the public square, and the town hall where the test would be applied and the money delivered, and damnable portraits of the Richardses and Pinkerton the banker and Cox and the foreman and Reverend Burgess and the postmaster, and even of Jack Halliday, who was the loafing, good-natured, no-account, irreverent fisherman, hunter, boy's friend, stray dog's friend, typical Sam Lawson of the town. The little mean-smirking, oily Pinkerton showed the sack to all comers, and rubbed his sleek palms together pleasantly, and enlarged upon the town's fine old reputation for honesty, and upon this wonderful endorsement of it, and hoped and believed that the example would now spread far and wide over the American world, and be epoch-making in the matter of moral regeneration, and so on and so on. By the end of a week, things had quieted down again. The wild intoxication of pride and joy had sobered to a soft, sweet, silent delight, a sort of deep, nameless, unutterable content. All faces bore a look of peaceful, holy happiness. Then a change came. It was a gradual change, so gradual that its beginnings were hardly noticed. Maybe were not noticed at all, except by Jack Halliday, who always noticed everything, and always made fun of it, too, no matter what it was. He began to throw out chaffing remarks about people not looking quite so happy as they did a day or two ago, and next he claimed that the new aspect was deepening to positive sadness, next that it was taking on a sick look, and finally he said that everybody was become so moody, thoughtful, and absent-minded that he could rob the meanest man in town of a cent out of the bottom of his breeches pocket and not disturb his reverie. At this stage, or at about this stage, a saying like this was dropped at bedtime, with a sigh usually, by the head of each of the 19 principal households. Ah, what could have been the remark that Goodson made? And straightway, with a shudder, came this from the man's wife.
"Oh, don't! What horrible thing are you mulling in your mind? Put it away from you, for God's sake!"
But that question was wrung from those men again the next night, and got the same retort, but weaker. And the third night the men uttered the question yet again, with anguish and absently. This time, and the following night, The wives fidgeted feebly, and tried to say something, but didn't. And the night after that they found their tongues, and responded, longingly, "Oh, if we could only guess!" Halliday's comments grew daily more and more sparklingly disagreeable and disparaging. He went diligently about, laughing at the town, individually and in mass. But his laugh was the only one left in the village. It fell upon a hollow and mournful vacancy and emptiness. Not even a smile was findable anywhere. Halliday carried a cigar box around on a tripod, playing that it was a camera, and halted all passers and aimed the thing and said, "Ready? Now look pleasant, please." But not even this capital joke could surprise the dreary faces into any softening. So 3 weeks passed. 1 week was left. It was Saturday evening, after supper. Instead of the aforetime Saturday evening flutter and bustle and shopping and larking, the streets were empty and desolate. Richards and his old wife sat apart in their little parlor, miserable and thinking. This was become their evening habit now, the lifelong habit which had preceded it of reading, knitting, and contented chat, or receiving or paying neighborly calls, was dead and gone and forgotten ages ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago. Nobody talked now, nobody read, nobody visited. The whole village sat at home sighing, worrying, silent, trying to guess out that remark. The postman left a letter. Richards glanced listlessly at the superscription and the postmark, unfamiliar both, and tossed the letter on the table, and resumed his might-have-beens and his hopeless dull miseries where he had left them off. 2 or 3 hours later his wife got wearily up and was going away to bed, without a good night. Custom now, but she stopped near the letter and eyed it a while, with a dead interest, then broke it open and began to skim it over. Richards, sitting there with his chair tilted back against the wall, and his chin between his knees, heard something fall. It was his wife. He sprang to her side, but she cried out, "Leave me alone! I am too happy! Read the letter! Read it!" He did. He devoured it, his brain reeling. The letter was from a distant state, and it said,
"I am a stranger to you, but no matter. I have something to tell. I have just arrived home from Mexico and learned about that episode. Of course you do not know who made that remark, but I know, and I am the only person living who does know. It was Goodson. I knew him well many years ago. I passed through your village that very night, and was his guest till the midnight train came along. I overheard him make that remark to the stranger in the dark. It was in Hale Alley. He and I talked of it the rest of the way home, and while smoking in his house. He mentioned many of your villagers in the course of his talk, most of them in a very uncomplimentary way, but 2 or 3 favorably. Among these latter, yourself. I say favorably, nothing stronger. I remember his saying he did not actually like any person in the town, not one, but that you, I think he said you, am almost sure, had done him a very great service once, possibly without knowing the full value of it, and he wished he had a fortune, he would leave it to you when he died, and a curse apiece for the rest of the citizens. Now then, if it was you that did him that service, you are his legitimate heir, and entitled to the sack of gold. I know that I can trust to your honor and honesty, for in a citizen of Hadleyburg these virtues are an unfailing inheritance, and so I am going to reveal to you the remark, well satisfied that if you are not the right man, you will seek and find the right one, and see that poor Goodson's debt of gratitude for the service referred to is paid. This is the remark. You are far from being a bad man. Go and reform. Howard L. Stevenson."
"Oh, Edward, the money is ours, and I am so grateful, oh, so grateful! kiss me, dear. It's forever since we kissed. And we needed it so, the money. And now you are free of Pinkerton and his bank, and nobody's slave any more. It seems to me I could fly for joy.
It was a happy half hour that the couple spent there on the settee, caressing each other. It was the old days come again, days that had begun with their courtship, and lasted without a break till the stranger brought the deadly money. By and by the wife said,
"Oh, Edward, how lucky it was you did him that grand service, poor Goodson. I never liked him, but I love him now. And it was fine and beautiful of you never to mention it or brag about it."
Then, with a touch of reproach,
"But you ought to have told me, Edward. You ought to have told your wife, you know."
"Well, Mary, you see—"
"Now stop hemming and hawing and tell me about it, Edward. I always loved you, and now I'm proud of you. Everybody believes there was only one good, generous soul in this village. And now it turns out that you—" "Edward, why don't you tell me?"
"Well, why, Mary, I can't."
"You can't? Why can't you?"
"Well, you see, he made me promise I wouldn't."
The wife looked him over and said very slowly,
"Made you promise? Edward, what do you tell me that for?"
"Mary, do you think I would lie?"
She was troubled and silent for a moment. Then she laid her hand within his and said,
"No, no. We have wandered far enough from our bearings. God spare us that. In all your life you have never uttered a lie. But now that the foundations of things seem to be crumbling from under us, we...
She lost her voice for a moment, then said brokenly,
"Lead us not into temptation. I think you made the promise, Edward. Let it rest so. Let us keep away from that ground. Now, that is all gone by. Let us be happy again. It is no time for clouds."
Edward found it something of an effort to comply, for his mind kept wandering, trying to remember what the service was that he had done Goodson. The couple lay awake the most of the night, Mary happy and busy, Edward busy but not so happy. Mary was planning what she would do with the money. Edward was trying to recall that service. At first his conscience was sore on account of the lie he had told Mary, if it was a lie. After much reflection, suppose it was a lie, what then? Was it such a great matter? Aren't we always acting lies? Then why not tell them? Look at Mary, look what she had done. While he was hurrying off on his honest errand, what was she doing? Lamenting because the papers hadn't been destroyed and the money kept. Is theft better than lying? That point lost its sting. The lie dropped into the background and left comfort behind it. The next point came to the front. Had he rendered that service? Well, here was Goodson's own evidence, as reported in Stevenson's letter. There could be no better evidence than that. It was even proof that he had rendered it. Of course. So that point was settled. No, not quite. He recalled with a wince that this unknown Mr. Stevenson was just a trifle unsure as to whether the performer of it was Richards or some other. And, oh dear, he had put Richards on his honor. He must himself decide whether that money must go. And Mr. Stevenson was not doubting that if he was the wrong man, he would go honorably and find the right one. Oh, it was odious to put a man in such a situation. Ah, why couldn't Stevenson have left out that doubt? What did he want to intrude that for? Further reflection. How did it happen that Richards's name remained in Stevenson's mind as indicating the right man, and not some other man's name? That looked good. Yes, that looked very good. In fact, it went on looking better and better straight along, until by and by it grew into positive proof. and then Richards put the matter at once out of his mind, for he had a private instinct that a proof once established is better left so. He was feeling reasonably comfortable now, but there was still one other detail that kept pushing itself on his notice. Of course he had done that service, that was settled, but what was that service? He must recall it. He would not go to sleep till he had recalled it. It would make his peace of mind perfect. And so he thought and thought. He thought of a dozen things, possible services, even probable services. But none of them seemed adequate. None of them seemed large enough. None of them seemed worth the money, worth the fortune Goodson had wished he could leave in his will. And besides, he couldn't remember having done them anyway. Now then, what kind of a service would it be that would make a man so inordinately grateful? Ah, the saving of his soul. That must be it. Yes, he could remember now how he once set himself the task of converting Goodson, and labored at it as much as, he was going to say 3 months, but upon closer examination it shrunk to a month, then to a week, then to a day, then to nothing. Yes, he remembered now, and with unwelcome vividness, that Goodson had told him to go to thunder and mind his own business. He wasn't hankering to follow Hadleyburg to heaven. So that solution was a failure. He hadn't saved Goodson's soul. Richards was discouraged. Then, after a little, came another idea. Had he saved Goodson's property? No, that wouldn't do. He hadn't any. His life? That is it. Of course. Why, he might have thought of it before.